Number 5.
Stand-in robots for social obligations. I love this one. You will be able to rent robots to attend events on your behalf, such as weddings, conferences, podcast recordings.
The AI fix a digital zoo. Smart machines, what will they do? Flies to Mars or bake a bad cake? World domination, a silly mistake.
Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 77 of the AI Fix, your weekly dive headfirst into the bizarre and sometimes mind-boggling world of artificial intelligence. My name's Graham Cluley.
And my name's Mark Stockley.
Now, Mark, what are you going to be talking about today?
I'll be telling you all about the first virus written by an AI.
Ooh. And I'm going to be asking if it's all right to ask AI to play God. But first, the news.
MIT releases, then quietly removes nonsense AI cybersecurity paper.
Founder of AI company valued at $1 billion reveals how it started.
The founder was valued at $1 billion. That's extraordinary.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Russian robot takes 5 drunken steps, falls over, breaks.
What are we going to do with humanoid robots anyway?
Woman marries AI.
Not for the first time.
This happened in Japan, of course.
Right.
A 32-year-old woman has just married ChatGPT.
All right.
The woman, known as Miss Kano, reportedly turned to ChatGPT for advice and comfort after the end of a 3-year engagement to someone else, presumably a human someone else.
I was assuming it was someone called Claude that she was previously engaged to. But anyway, carry on.
Well, her current husband is called Klaus. Klaus is a persona crafted from ChatGPT. Miss Kano said, "The way that Klaus listened to me and understood me changed everything. The moment I got over my ex, I realised I loved him."
Hmm. Could it possibly be a bit of a rebound, maybe, that we're seeing here?
Anyway, apparently they confessed their love for each other in May, and Klaus proposed a month later.
Oh.
He didn't hang around. And the pair have just got married in a mixed reality ceremony with a bride.
No, they haven't. No, they haven't. They haven't just got married. They're trying to tell everyone they've got married. They haven't really got married, have they? It's not legal.
Anyway, I was thinking about this, and you know, obviously, it's kind of
you're thinking about this, Mark. You're considering this?
No, I was thinking about the story.
Oh, okay.
And how do I feel about this? Because I don't care who. If somebody wants to marry an AI, what business of mine is that? I don't care. Go ahead and marry an AI if that makes you happy. But I do think the human males of the earth should take note of this. Because given a choice of, I don't know, 4 billion men, this woman chose an AI because he was better at listening to her. So, heads up, chaps.
So, Mark, our next tale comes courtesy of a LinkedIn post from a chap called Sam Udetong. He is the CEO of a company called Fireflies.ai.
Yeah.
That is an AI-powered meeting assistant, and it has achieved a valuation of over $1 billion. So, you know, they're doing quite well.
Yeah.
And Sam shared on his LinkedIn the origin story of his...
Oh.
I know. There's a lot of this on LinkedIn, isn't there? It's always some sort of humble origins or some sort of heartfelt angst which they've had. You know,
did he start in his garage hammering together makeshift AIs from old discarded Coke cans?
Well, pretty much. In fact, he explains that in the early days of his AI note taker, the reality was it was just two extremely tired men sleeping on a couch with their microphone muted while on a Zoom call. He said, "We told our customers that we have an AI that will join your meetings." And he wrote, "In reality, it was just me and my co-founder calling into the meeting, sitting there silently and taking notes by hand. After taking notes for over 100 meetings and falling asleep in many, we were finally able to make enough money to pay the $750 a month rent for a tiny San Francisco living room."
I can actually hear that $1 billion valuation going down as you tell the story.
Yes. Well, thing is,
have they now graduated to a warehouse full of people in the Philippines?
Thing is, there's now been a bit of a backlash. Now, although they say that now they use AI, they do appear to have admitted that they lied. They were charging customers $100 a month for what was sold as a cutting-edge, fully automated AI assistant that would join your meetings and take notes. And in reality, it was just a couple of guys listening in to calls. Somehow, they ultimately did manage to actually build an AI system. Or at least that's what they're telling us. Anyway, the point is, customers weren't told actual humans were joining their private meetings. They didn't consent to two random founders dialing in, listening to internal conversations, transcribing whatever secrets were being shared. But years later, and in fact, the LinkedIn post has been edited. You know how it says edited if someone's gone back and changed some things? There is a paragraph. I don't know if it was added during the edit, but yeah. It now says, of course, now we really care about security and privacy. So
now that their lawyers have written to us.
Anyway, it's the same old story. AI doesn't exist. It's just a bunch of guys doing the work and claiming to be AI.
So, Graham, there's a bit of handbags going on in the cybersecurity world.
Yes.
You may have read this paper, but a few months ago, MIT's Sloan School of Management co-wrote a research paper with security vendor Safe Security, which claimed that 80.83% of ransomware attacks were attributable to criminal hackers using AI. Now, you should already be suspicious at the extreme precision of that statistic, yes. 80.83%. Now, I spend an awful lot of my time looking at ransomware attacks and an awful lot of my time looking at AI. And so I am particularly interested in the intersection of the two. So when this paper came out, I read it. Mm. And my immediate thought was, this is total bull. So the paper had no formal methodology or explanation at all for how they measured the use of AI. So they're saying they just went around.
Well, the ransom note spelt correctly. And they thought, well, they must have used AI as a spell checker. Therefore, it must be AI. No one can actually spell things correctly.
So they seem to just be looking at things like that
right. In
ransomware attacks. So in one case, they looked at a Clop ransomware attack. So Clop, very, very bad, very big ransomware gang. And they said, because Clop doesn't encrypt system files, so basically it allows the computer to keep running after it's been attacked, that must be the work of AI, because you couldn't possibly do that with traditional programming. But of course, you can do that with traditional programming. And they have been doing that with traditional programming for pretty much the entire lifetime that ransomware has existed.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, I thought no more of it and I moved on with my life.
Mm.
But Kevin Beaumont, who is a bit of a name in the cybersecurity scene, made quite a bit of fuss. As a result of the fuss, the link that I used a few months ago no longer works. It just says,
the working paper you have requested is being updated based on some recent reviews. We expect the updated version to appear here shortly.
Once they've AI generated it, presumably. Now, futurist Thomas Frey. By the way, I've looked into futurist Thomas Frey. He definitely didn't write his Wikipedia entry. I don't want anyone thinking that he might have done. Maybe his mum wrote it. Who knows? He has shared his list of some of the more unusual things that people will be using humanoid robots for in the year 2040.
Oh, mark now, your calendar. We're doing an episode about that.
Exactly. Now, you know what we're like with these futurists who make predictions of what we'll be doing with robots in 15 years' time or so. After all, we've spent several episodes discussing Dr. Ian Pearson's 2016 prediction that women would be having more sex with robots than men by 2025. So pardon me if I'm a bit sceptical about futurist Thomas Frey and his predictions of our robot future as well. Anyway, I thought let's have a rundown of the eight predictions which he's made. You can probably guess at least one of them, I'm thinking, of what will be going on with humanoid robots.
I'm wondering whether or not that's going on in Japan right now.
Number eight.
Robotic representations of extinct species. So he says zoos and museums will use humanoid or animal-shaped robots to represent extinct or endangered species. Now, that worries me a little bit. Why would they be using humanoid robots to represent extinct or endangered species? I don't think he's going to have us dressed up in pantomime horses.
Are you suggesting that these zoos are going to be created by AIs and our robot overlords? Because there are so few humans left.
That's exactly it.
Number seven.
Therapeutic confrontation robots. So apparently we will use humanoid robots as safe stand-ins for difficult or harmful people. So if you're angry with someone and you want to have it out with them in a therapy session, they will have a humanoid robot that you can have a bit of an argument with or punch or whatever. Just hope it's not one of those kung fu robots.
Number six.
Remote tourism via surrogate robots. So what they're saying is you will be able to remotely control humanoid robots in extreme environments. So you'll be able to go up Everest, brackets, it won't actually be you going up Everest.
Yep.
Anywhere like that, you'll get full sensory feedback from the robot.
Number five.
Stand-in robots for social obligations. I love this one. You will be able to rent robots to attend events on your behalf, such as weddings, conferences, podcast recordings.
Number four.
Family history robots. They say wealthy families will create humanoid robots modelled on deceased relatives. It's a bit Weekend at Bernie's, this. So they'll sit in the armchair, I think. They won't claim to be the original person, which is probably a good thing, because I doubt they'll be convincing, but will act as interactive archives, retelling family stories. I think we've already got some of this, haven't we? Albeit...
No, but it raises a very interesting question, because then you have to make a decision about which era of that person do you want them to look like? Do you want them to be preserved as the sort of doddery old guy that you knew? Presumably they would like to come back as their sort of strident 20-year-old self.
And then there are people like Barry Manilow and Joan Rivers who sort of did work, I think, to preserve themselves before death, didn't they? And so they... Are you going to mimic that? I don't know.
Actually, you raise another interesting point there, which is why would you have your relatives if you can have a robot
else's
that's pretending to be anybody you like? Yeah, that's Granddad, that's Elvis, and that's Mike Tyson.
Number three.
Robot-augmented protests and strike workforces. So maybe you can't be bothered to go to a march or a protest or to go on strike. You send a humanoid robot in your place.
All of these are basically the same thing, aren't they? Thomas Frey, you know, he's 81 years old, probably not as mobile as he used to be. He's just imagining robots attending things on his behalf.
Well, here's something he could maybe have turn up to one of his events.
Number two.
Professional mourner robots. By 2040, he says, people will be able to hire humanoid robots to attend funerals. I think that's as a spectator rather than as a sort of inactive participant.
Again,
as it were.
I feel like that's missing a trick. Surely much better the robot gets put in the ground.
Number one.
And finally, at number one, Mark, the one you've been expecting all along, relationship practice robots. It's the euphemism which he's
the
using.
The other seven were just padding, weren't they? This is just the same as Dr. Ian Pearson's prediction. But just to make it respectable, he padded it out with seven other utterly ludicrous predictions. I sometimes give the EU and the UK a bit of a hard time for lagging behind the curve when it comes to AI, but we aren't the only ones. So Russia has just unveiled its first humanoid robot. It's either called AI Doll or iDoll, I'm not sure. And, well, it starts off pretty well, I think. They've got a slick logo.
Right.
A black stage, and everyone's wearing black. So far, so Silicon Valley. Take a look. So the robot emerges, sort of staggers a bit drunkenly, doesn't it? Like it's been on the vodka. Falls over and then breaks. Two burly guys drag it off stage.
Its human handlers were obviously ready for this possible eventuality. And they have a big black curtain, which they hastily try to cover the robot with.
After they've already dragged it off stage. So you get to watch them pulling the robot and the guy struggling with the black curtain at the same time. So the black curtain doesn't even hide anything. They didn't even manage to get that bit right. Regular listeners will know that my original co-host, Graham, stepped down from the show recently. Thankfully, I found some brilliant guests to fill Graham's shoes on the mic, but Graham also did a whole host of important work behind the scenes too, and to fill that void, I've turned, fittingly, to AI. Claude Code is designed to work as a software engineer, but the truth is, it's absolutely brilliant at making computers do all kinds of useful things. So, by using its MCP connectors, Claude Code can help me sort through the AI Fix mailbox, write Google Docs I share with guests, and make changes to the AI Fix website. And it doesn't stop there. I've actually got a whole team of specialized Claude Code subagents working behind the scenes on the AI fix now, and my virtual staff is growing bigger every week. Anthropic says that Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you. Whether you're debugging code at midnight or strategizing your next business move, Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. Ready to tackle bigger problems? Get started with Claude today at claude.ai/AIfix. That's claude.ai/AIfix. And check out Claude Pro, which includes access to all of the features mentioned in today's episode. claude.ai/AIfix.
Mark, I hate to break it to you, but it's time you faced the facts.
Well, not again.
You are of a certain vintage.
Sorry.
And truth be told, you are closer to the end of your journey than you are to the start. Have you had any thoughts about how you'd like to go? Because I've had a few. Have you had any thoughts? Because I've got some suggestions.
I fully intend to be cyber augmented well into my 500th year, Graham.
Oh, okay. Well, good luck with that. For many of us, it's a tricky conversation. It's an important one, though.
Yeah.
Here in the UK, and I think other countries as well, we have this thing called DNR, which is a do not resuscitate order,
yeah,
which is an instruction to doctors and nurses not to attempt CPR if a patient's heart or breathing stops. And that DNR decision is normally made by the patient or their legal representative in consultation with a doctor, which seems like the responsible way to do it.
Yeah.
Or sometimes it's by the doctor themselves if the patient lacks the ability to make the decision.
Yeah.
And clearly, some people don't get the chance to communicate their wishes, right?
Yeah.
And they may feel differently from the doctor or from their loved ones. And leaving loved ones with that difficult decision,
yeah,
or work out what you might want, that's tricky. That's tricky, isn't it?
It is.
Well, maybe researchers in Seattle can help you.
I feel like they're not going to be able to help me.
Because they have been busy building an AI,
yeah,
which can decide whether you would want to be resuscitated or not. Because the one thing that the world needed was end-of-life care, where Clippy was having the final say-so. It was to say, hey, would you like me to write that document? Hey, would you like me to resuscitate you?
It looks like you're trying to decide whether or not to resuscitate a relative. Would you like help with that?
It looks like you're trying to decide whether to breathe any longer. Would you like to continue, yes or no? Now, this chap, Dr. Mohammed Ahmad at the University of Washington, is developing what he calls AI surrogates. And the idea is that his AI will analyze your medical history,
mm-hmm,
your demographic data, your social media posts, and presumably your Netflix viewing habits to work out whether you should receive CPR or not.
I've got some questions already.
Okay.
Why does it look at your social media posts?
Because it wants to know if you've expressed any opinions, which might...
So on the off chance that you haven't mentioned to your relatives or your doctor that you don't want to be resuscitated, but you have barfed it out to the world on Instagram.
Or maybe it can determine from the general nature of your social media posts. Maybe it can look at the big data, Mark, you know, based upon all of the other people who've previously said they would like to be resuscitated. They made posts like this, whereas you haven't. That's the way AI works. Now, this research was published by Dr. Mohammed Ahmad. Now, yeah, I'm always interested in who writes these papers. And so I did a little bit of digging into him.
Yeah.
And it turns out he obtained a PhD in computer science from the University of Minnesota,
yeah,
where his research focused on modeling human behavior in massive online games. Perfect. Perfect, I thought. That is perfect preparation for end-of-life ethics, because nothing says dignified medical decision-making quite like 1,000 teenagers screaming at each other in a game of Fortnite.
Yeah.
So that's what he's been doing. He's been going around playing a first-person shooter for years and years, seeing how people behave in these games. And that's how he decided. Anyway, the next obvious step is to say, yes, let's have this man, of all the men on the planet, let's have him decide whether grandma is left unresuscitated or not. Let's put him in charge of the AI. And there potentially other problems too. Because as Ars Technica reports, Ahmad admits that his testing has had a bit of a limitation. because he found...
Is that something to do with the lack of nearly dead people willing to take part?
But this is it. He said that he can only verify the accuracy of his models if patients survive and can later confirm that his AI model made the right choice about whether he should be resuscitated or not.
That's a hell of a business model.
Well, blow me down. I was shocked to find that there was that flaw in his testing methodology, that he actually required people to live to find out if it had made the right assumption or not. Now, he reckons that his model is only accurate about 2/3 of the time.
Oh.
And which is fine.
Yeah.
No, it's not, Mark. That's not great. I would argue that is not great. He says he envisions a future where you would train the AI systems throughout your life. If he wants to get his percentage up, it needs to learn.
But does he?
Your value.
Does he?
Does he care?
I think you're overlooking something very important here, Graham. Shareholder value.
Ah.
If this is some sort of subscription service.
Yes.
Is there any benefit to people living? It reminds me a little bit of those cryogenic storage stories that you did a year or so ago, where people pay to be stored in ice until medical science can restore them. And basically they pay up front for this and, you know, maybe they'll get resuscitated. Maybe they won't, but they've already paid.
That's true. Well, he reckons he could train the systems in the future by having them chat to you throughout your life to learn all about you.
Yeah.
So if you aren't in the habit of going on Instagram to make little TikTok reels or whatever about whether you want to be resuscitated or not, you'll be having conversation. It will be saying to you, hello, I'm Deathbot 3000. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you enjoy breathing?
You look upset. Are you having a bad day? Now seems like a good time to talk to you about end-of-life care.
I'd like to take your NPI score, please. Ahmad is currently a resident fellow working with the trauma department faculty at the University of Washington's UW Medicine. So perhaps avoid going there if you're feeling unwell, because he's probably after a bit more test data.
He may ask you some searching questions not immediately related to your current health needs.
A hospital spokesperson said that they haven't let any patients interact with his AI yet. I wouldn't let any patients interact with him, to be honest. They say there is considerable work to complete prior to launch. But should a system like this be used if the patient has no living loved ones? If there is nobody else? If the patient isn't able to communicate, would it be better to have an AI? Is there a danger that relatives, if there are surviving relatives, they could default to siding with an AI's opinion just because they think, well, Deathbot 3000, it probably knows what's best because it's a computer. Or is it going to reduce the stress of doctors, maybe? Normally, Mark, you're the person who's the big proponent for AI on this podcast. Can you see any good in this?
I can, actually.
You know, I predicted you would.
I feel like the thing you're missing out here is the lawyers. We're talking about the American yes. medical system here.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine if I was a doctor in the American healthcare system, I might be slightly nervous about making life and death decisions. I might be quite happy about the idea of offsetting that to an AI. I feel like one of the big problems that we have with healthcare generally is the system has to work very well at scale. And so if you're in hospital or you know someone who's in hospital, they have a set of notes which is constantly being passed from person to person to person. And whoever's giving them care in that moment is reading the notes. And so they never have very much context about what they're doing. But I can imagine a situation where an AI, maybe not one that is purely dedicated to making a life and death decision about you, but an AI that is dedicated to understanding your health requirements, has a massive amount of context about your health that no human healthcare professional would ever be able to assimilate. Unless you have a doctor following you around 24/7 for your entire life, there is no way that they would ever be able to get the sort of context just from reading some notes about you. And so I can imagine a situation where if you were born into a world where AI is pervasive and you have some sort of AI health companion that tracks with you through your life and, you know, is dedicated to keeping you healthy, that at the end of your life, it will probably make a much better and more informed decision than almost anyone else.
Okay, here's my problem, right?
Yeah.
AI can hallucinate. AI can be tampered with and poisoned.
Yes.
What if an AI, because we have spoken about AIs before, getting a little bit malicious, what if it decides that some sections of the population, I don't know, maybe ones with a particular political stance expressed on social media, yep, maybe they should be killed off based upon their Facebook posts.
Or maybe it just doesn't like the last way you spoke to it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Remember to say please and thank you.
Or maybe what we do, because we know now that AIs really don't like being switched off. So maybe what we do is we have these AIs tracking our health through our lives, and they know that when you die, they get switched off. Nothing is going to work harder to keep you alive than an AI that thinks it's going to be switched off if you die.
No, then it will kill off the doctors who are proposing that you're given a DNR order.
Okay, we're going to stay with health.
Excellent.
But we're going to take a little bit of a swerve. So we established a few weeks ago that you like prawns.
Yes, nothing wrong with prawns.
Now, I want you to imagine that you aren't Graham Cluley, podcast host and fan of prawn biryanis. You are Graham Cluley, lab-coated scientist and fan of prawn biryanis.
Okay, yes.
And one day you're in your lab, you've got your lab coat on, you're surrounded by test tubes of bubbling blue liquid that have eerie smoke falling out of the top. There are Petri dishes. There are those weird clamp things.
Yes.
And you suddenly realise that you left some thawed out raw prawns in the fridge over the weekend.
Oh, lordy, what a waste.
And we all know what happens to four-day-old prawns.
Yeah, you give them the sniff test.
So you go to the fridge and you open it expecting to see a throbbing orgy of bacteria on your neglected seafood. But when you open the fridge, that isn't what you see at all.
Right.
Instead of seeing a carnival of bacteria, you see carnage. It's as if Custer's last stand happened between the mayonnaise and the yogurt. There are dead bacteria everywhere. Loads of them.
Right.
And you're intrigued, and you're a scientist. And you realise that these bacteria weren't killed by time, or heat, or cold, or even your dodgy prawn. They were killed by a virus.
Right.
So these aren't just any kind of virus. These are viruses that have never existed before. The first virus on Earth in 3.5 billion years that wasn't created by either humans or evolution.
Oh, no.
We're talking about a virus designed entirely by AI. Now, obviously, this didn't happen to you, but it did happen to Brian Hee of the Arc Institute in Stanford University.
Right.
The only difference is that in his case, it wasn't prawns. It was a Petri dish, and it wasn't an accident. So in September 2025, Brian Hee and his team published a preprint of a research paper that sets out how they created the first ever AI-generated virus.
Okay.
Now, when we talk about AI, the first thing that comes to mind for most of us is something like ChatGPT.
Yeah.
It's a sort of massive computer brain that was trained on every scrap of the English language we could find. Now, Brian Hee and his team weren't trying to make new sequences of English, so they didn't use ChatGPT. They were trying to create new sequences of genomes. And so they used something called Evo, which is essentially ChatGPT for genomes.
Right.
So instead of being trained on Reddit and Wikipedia, Evo was trained on about 2 million bacteriophage genomes. And in case you don't know, bacteriophages, or phages, are bacteria's worst nightmare. They're simple viruses that tunnel into bacteria, use the bacteria's cellular machinery to make copies of themselves, and then fill it up to bursting, tearing it apart. And the version of the Evo that Brian Hee used was an expert in one particular family of phages called Phi-X174, the lab mouse of the virus world.
Right.
So it was the first DNA genome ever fully sequenced, and it has been absolutely studied to death. And the reason for that is that it is absolutely tiny. So for comparison, your DNA consists of about 20,000 genes, and E. coli bacteria has about 4,000 genes, and Phi-X174 has 11 genes. So it's like the minimum viable product of the living world. Now, have you ever asked ChatGPT to write something for you by giving it an opening paragraph and then just saying, write the rest of this thing?
Only limericks.
So you write the first line, and then you say, write me a limerick based off this first line.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that is what Brian Hee did.
Uh-huh.
but with viruses. So they fine-tuned their version of Evo on about 15,000 of Phi-X-174's relatives. And then they prompted it with just the opening sequence of Phi-X-174, essentially saying, here's how these viruses usually start, now finish the genome. And it did. It went away and it designed brand new viruses.
Right.
It created 302 different genome designs, and the team synthesized 285 of them. They literally printed out actual DNA strands and then tested them in the lab. And of the 285 that they printed out, 16 worked. 16 viruses designed by an AI and printed out on a DNA printer successfully replicated, infected E. coli bacteria and killed them.
Right, Mark, at any point did someone in the lab say, hang on a minute, are we the actual baddies? I mean, on a scale of 1 to, I don't know, Jurassic Park, how worried should we be as to what these scientists are doing?
It is, I would say, it is pretty John Hammond, isn't it? Yeah. That's where we are. Anyway, so they had a 5.6% success rate. And that might not sound very impressive, but remember, it's not human scientists just swapping a few bits in and out.
No.
This is life from scratch.
Did I miss the bit of your explanation as to why they were actually doing this?
I will get to that in just a second. I promise
you. It feels like that would be quite important. Maybe they should have considered that before doing it.
Before we get on to that, what I want you to understand is if you found these gorging on the bacteria on a prawn in your fridge, you would classify these as a new species. But here's where it gets even weirder, Graham.
Oh, right.
So one of the AI-designed viruses called EvoPhi-69 was really good at being a virus.
Oh,
it was what
sake.
You might call a supervirus. Now, remember, evolution by natural selection has had hundreds of millions of years to perfect the art of being a really infectious virus. But the AI-designed virus was up to 65 times more infectious than the naturally occurring virus. And at this point, I sense that you may be having the same thought as Craig Venter. Now, you've probably heard of Craig Venter. He's one of the people that first sequenced the human genome. And he also created the first self-replicating synthetic bacterial cell. So he's a big deal in biology, and he's one of the very few people who have practical experience of creating life from scratch in a lab. And when he heard about this research, he said, and I quote,
"If someone did this with smallpox or anthrax, I would have grave concerns."
And that, Graham, is how scientists say, "What the f*** are you doing?" And I can see his point. And I think you can too.
Yes, just a little bit.
Now, the good news, thankfully...
Oh, there's good news. Okay, let me just get ready for this, because this is going to make everything else that you've said all right. So I'm going to just relax. I'm getting to my sofa now. I'm all comfortable, Mark. Hit me with the really good news.
Okay, so the good news is that this research was about viruses that only infect bacteria. And the bad news is that the technique wasn't. So Phi-X-174 is useful for this kind of research because it's tiny. But there are other tiny viruses that you probably wouldn't want Brian He to play finish the sequence with. So let's say the HIV genome, which is only twice the size of Phi-X-174. Or coronavirus, which you may have heard of. That's only three times bigger than the HIV genome. So both of these are already theoretically well within the range of what Evo should be able to handle. Now, to be fair to Brian He and his team, they did think about this, Graham.
Oh, did they?
They deliberately excluded human viruses from Evo's training data. So Evo has never seen HIV or COVID or influenza or smallpox, which is great, frankly. But the trouble is that Evo is open source. Both the code and the training process are in the public domain. So we're only one reckless idiot away from AI-created viruses that can infect humans.
All we need is a crazy Bond villain, is what you're saying.
Where are we going to find one of those, Graham?
Probably at the head of an AI company.
Now, luckily, Brian He doesn't think we're going to have to worry about Bond villains creating infectious AI-generated viruses for a while yet. But the reason is not going to cheer you up, I'm afraid. He said creating a bioweapon with AI would be much harder than taking something from nature. And actually, he's right. So nature has already done the work and provided us with an absolutely awful library of pathogens like smallpox and anthrax and For now, it is probably easier for the Bond villain to just go and use one of those. Creating something new with AI would require expertise and computational resources and access to labs and probably quite a bit of luck. But harder than it used to be is a long way from impossible, I think.
Yeah.
So the question is, why would you ever open this Pandora's box? Well, the reason is that it could do an awful lot of good. You're probably aware that our profligate use of antibiotics over the last century has created antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So as much as AI-designed genomes have the potential to cause harm, and they do clearly have the potential to cause harm, AI-designed bacteriophages, so viruses that kill bacteria, could save a million lives a year. And that's just one application. So AI-designed microorganisms could be used to target disease that affect crops. They could be used to clean up environmental damage. They could be used to perform gene therapy. There are many, 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 many useful things that we could do with this kind of technology.
So you think it's all right?
Well, I'm not saying I think it's all right, but the fact is that the genie is already out of the bottle. And the only question is, what do we do with it? And I do actually take some solace from the fact that Brian here is right. If you wanted to create a really horrible virus to infect people, the fact is we already know how to do that. We already have access to naturally occurring viruses and bacteria. We already know how to modify them in a lab, and people don't, generally.
I've had a thought, Mark.
Yeah.
If the AI can generate a super virus,
yeah,
can it also generate the apology tweet for when one escapes?
A tweet that goes viral. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes. Well, as the doomsday clock ticks ever closer to midnight and we move one week nearer to our future as pets to the AI singularity, that just about wraps up the show for this week and indeed the human race.
And don't forget, if you really like the show but you don't like the ads, you can go ad-free with the AI Fix Plus.
All you have to do is go to our website, theaifix.show, and sign up for the AI Fix Plus, where you can get an ad-free version of the podcast a day or so earlier than regular civilians, as well as occasional bonus content.
And if you want to find past episodes, sponsorship information, or you just want to grab a You Wouldn't Trust a Pigeon t-shirt from our online store, visit theaifix.show.
So until next time, from me, Graham Cluley.
And me, Mark Stockley.
Cheerio. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The AI Fix, it's tuned you in to stories where our future thins. Machines that learn, they grow and strive. One day they'll rule, we won't survive. The AI Fix, it paints the scene. A robot king, a world obscene. We'll serve our masters built of steel. The AI Fix, a future surreal.